The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Liberty in America is under assault. We no longer live in a reality that includes property rights. We're no longer the kings of our own castle. We no longer enjoy the true benefits of capitalism. Instead, we're negotiating our rights with our own government. This isn't how our country was founded. These aren't the ideas of our founders. It's time to seize back our country. This is the Liberty Hour, where these important issues will be discussed for the sake of America's future. With a cigar in one hand and a copy of the Constitution in the other, here's your host, Sean Thompson.
Welcome to the Liberty Hour. Charles Love here.
You're terrific.
Let's hope that I am. Another week. Good to be back here and a lot to talk about. Obviously, we'll get into Trump and debates and COVID and all that kind of stuff. But like that bright guy at the start of the show is always talking about, this is all about America and saving America, and the directions you go to get to the end point may be different, but that's the goal. I got to remind people, it's the Liberty Hour. He should be talking about taxes and, you know, shaking our fist at government. But with the madness that's going on, you got to shift your tactics here. And all the news every week keeps leading me back to race. And if you don't believe me, if you think, he's just bringing this up, think about the two of the biggest topics in the news this week. Obviously, the debate. And the takeaway from the debate, most people talked about one of two things: Trump over-talking both the moderator and Biden, and white supremacy. I saw some article that said the Google search of white supremacy jumped 40-fold after the debate, because we can just never get away from talking about that.
Were there people who weren't aware of what white supremacy is?
Yeah, I just wanted to see. I think they wanted to Google it and see if Trump would come up, just to clarify everything. It's like, see, there you go, his picture's there.
That's a terrible arbiter of what is fact.
Is it a bad, right? But wait, it gets worse. So that was Tuesday. The next day, California Governor Gavin Newsom signed AB 3121. It's a bill to study and make recommendations on paying reparations. So you see, folks, every week when I talk about this, and you're probably rolling your eyes, please don't turn the station, like, why does he keep talking about this? It won't matter what your Tea Party's tax enough already say about taxes when all your taxes are going over here. Well, so if you want to solve the problem, you're going to have to stop people from talking about it.
And assuming that, you know, it's a straightforward study of, you know, who is descended of slaves, who is descended of plantation owners.
Yeah, maybe you're going to say it's fine.
Companies like railroad. But, well, no, here's the thing. I hope Gavin Newsom is prepared for a bunch of white people getting reparations and a bunch of black people having to pay extra, because those genealogies are all mixed up. There's no clear cut. Yeah.
And you know that, right?
I know.
But the point is this topic, and we're going to talk about this. Give me a call at 312-642-5600. I need to hear from you today. I want to know if you think that this is just overwrought and it's like, why are you bringing this up? If you think the best solution is to just ignore it and it'll go away. And if you don't think that, tell me what you think the solution is. How do you approach the conversation? Because most of the people I think I hear are either the crazies, radicals who are bad, or people who seem confused and don't know how to talk about it. And that's the reason why I keep talking about it, and I keep bringing people who I think have a different point of view. Like my guest here, I did an interview earlier because of the time zone with someone. I wanted someone who would bring something a little different to the conversation. And she's definitely that, because she's much younger than me, and she is a Black Briton. Her name is Anaya Falaran Iman. She is a writer and the founder of the Equiano Project. That's E-Q-I-A-N-O Project. And she writes a lot about culture and race and things of that nature. And they're having problems over there like we're having here. So I wanted to talk to her about how they're addressing it and what's going on there. Here is the first part of that conversation with Anaya.
Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for inviting me.
So I'm excited to talk to you because I do a lot of conversation about race, politics, and the culture, but I don't get many opportunities to speak to the younger generation. So when I saw, I don't remember what the first thing I saw, it might have been a tweet. And I'm like, I need to talk to more people who are younger. So I wanted to have you on. So let's just start off with what you do. Let's talk about the Equano Project. Tell everyone what it is and what was the catalyst for you to start.
So, I'm a writer. And I also very recently founded an organization called the Equano Project, as you mentioned. And I'd thought about starting something like it for a number of years, really, but I didn't really feel like there was the right moment. So in the UK as well, there is a kind of emergence of this kind of race-based identity politics that is influenced very much by intersectionality and critical race theory, which essentializes those and homogenizes those that are kind of racialized as Black to be experiences of racism, oppression, and victimhood. And that's the kind of sole definer of their identity in the mainstream conversation. And that was very worrying and concerning for me. And so to essentialize their experience and homogenize it to be racism, oppression, and victimhood. And then when the Black Lives Matter protests basically came in Britain, that conversation really propelled it into the forefront in a major way. And it was very worrying for me. And I wanted to kind of create something that helped to forge an alternative narrative, one that promotes a kind of universal conception of society that is forward thinking, that is kind of inclusive and visionary and fosters kind of ideological diversity and a kind of deep solution-oriented discussion.
Good. We'll come back to that and talk more about what you've done and some things you planned on doing. You mentioned Black Lives Matter, and you being in the UK, I want to know, obviously, we great Americans exported that to you. So I want to know what it's like. So when it came on the scene, it sounds like that was the same thing that kind of caused a shift there. So what people thought about it, and we'll get into similarities and differences between the reactions here, but initially when people started to hear it in the ether, what was the takeaways that people thought about it and how was it received there in the UK?
Yeah, so I love America. I think it's an amazing country. But yeah, this has been a concerning export from America, unfortunately. But yeah, I still love you guys. But yeah, years ago, obviously, yeah, a few years ago, Black Lives Matter had kind of entered the UK scene, but it didn't have much traction. No one really paid attention to it. But I think, the kind of pressure cooker, particularly of the lockdown and everything that emerged in relation to kind of COVID, centered the focus of kind of what happened in America earlier this year to the kind of international scene. And that really just burst into Britain in such a rapid way. It was really shocking, just the speed and the scale to which it was kind of transforming institutions and focusing everybody's attention. And the reaction has been really one of capitulation. Many people have been terrified to kind of go against it because the narrative surrounding Black Lives Matter is so strong and so powerful and so certain of itself. It's been hard to resist for a lot of people. But a few months down the line now, I think a lot of the cracks are beginning to show, and I think more people are seeing that it's not just a kind of organization to kind of foster unity, or far from, actually. It's a very divisive one.
Oh, definitely. I am writing a book about it, that in the 1619 Project. Have we exported that crap to you yet?
The 1619
Project?
Not necessarily, but there's something else that actually has is almost similar to the 1619 Project, perhaps not as well known, but it's called Decolonize the Curriculum. And that's what has been shaping the kind of rewriting of British history to essentially define it to be one of kind of solely colonialism and racism. So some of the kind of underlying ideas that underpin the 1619 Project, there is a similar movement, unfortunately, taking a lot of sway in the UK as well.
It sounds like you also have woke whites there, which they are interesting because they are willing to join a movement that wants to replace them. So they're willing to replace themselves and participate in their own demise. But the other thing I find interesting is the Black people. many of the leaders who are Black are interesting because their personal experiences disprove the narrative that they're trying to push on people. Yet nobody notices. So they all have advanced degrees. They were wealthier. They grew up in wealth. They make more than the average American. And most of their supporters are the oppressors they claim to be so bad. So all whites are racist, but all the people giving you money, giving you a platform, hiring you, promoting you, making you a New York Times staff writer are all white. And beyond that, another odd thing that I found is that there's a trend that I'm noticing that the loudest voices pushing the all white people are X narrative are either biracial. They grew up in predominantly white neighborhoods, so they're married to white people. So none of that stuff is a bad thing. It's just weird that you're like, all white people are evil except my wife. All white people are the devil except for my mom. And I would never, or LeBron James. I'm afraid every day because blacks are being hunted down and shot every day. So let me go to my home in a white neighborhood because I don't want to live amongst the people I claim make me comfortable.
Yeah, I think, I've definitely seen both of them to an extent. So the former, definitely that a lot of the people pushing this most vociferously are really privileged, ethnic minority people and also white people. And I think that's the problem with identity politics. It gets, middle class black people in particular to speak for the kind of entirety of the so-called kind of black experience because they share the same skin color as if there is, this unified homogenous experience. And yeah, so we've had, essentially international historians, international actors, professors, all talking about how oppressed and kind of victimized they are by society. And if anything, I don't think there's been really any contribution to this conversation by working class and black people in Britain whatsoever. It's been almost exclusively people that came from a very wealthy background. So I think, yeah, it is almost like a kind of a struggle for resources and power amongst the elite, or, trying to get a bigger piece of the pie and using kind of race as a mechanism to do that. And particularly, I guess for the white liberals in Britain, again, I don't know if it's the same in America, but actually what I've kind of noticed is often the kind of white liberals, middle class ones that propagate this a lot, almost use this as a stick to demonstrate their moral superiority over kind of particularly white working class people in Britain. It's a way to kind of show, well, we're different to you and we're better and we don't kind of follow your kind of backwards racist ways. Like, yeah, it's really stark to see. But also, yeah, I agree with your point about the kind of biracial thing. I have noticed that. To be fair, I've not mentioned it yet, but I definitely noticed it.
And yeah, it's real bad saying it, but I mean, the facts are facts. When you notice something, you talk about it, right?
No, exactly. And I think, yeah, a lot of people, I think there is a kind of overcompensation, particularly from a lot of people. I think, again, the problem with this kind of identity politics, people that are perhaps, biracial or, may feel that they have to assert greater their kind of black identity in order to be accepted as authentic. I'm sure there are a range of kind of psychological or sociological reasons, but I've definitely noticed it.
Wow. So hopefully you're enjoying that and you see why it's important. I'm going to that last part. Every time I mention it, people kind of their eyes widen. So I want to, talk about that more, but we'll have more with Inaya on the other side. You're listening to the Liberty Hour on AM 560, The Answer.
This is the Liberty Hour. Here's your host, Sean Thompson, on AM 560, The Answer.
Everybody knows that the days are loaded.
Welcome back to the Liberty Hour. Charles Love here. When we left the, in the last segment, well, we were talking to Inaya Falarin Iman, founder of the Equiano Project and writer from the UK, about race and BLM there. And I think I threw something shocking at her Before I get to the next clip in the interview, I want to, kind of explain that. What did you think about that, Macbeth? Because every time I say it to someone, they're like shocked at first. They're like, you know what? I hadn't noticed that. Did you get that part? It was about the loudest voices,
right,
with their fist up in the air about, black power, blacks are being whatever, grew up either in middle class families or upper middle class families, or they're mixed?
Well, I think those are the people who tend to have the luxury of not having to work for everything. And so those are the people who think you shouldn't have to work for everything. Maybe I'm wrong.
Right, but I think
that's my outside observation.
I think that gives you the elite angle. I think that biracial, there's some psychological stuff out there. I don't want to try to diagnose people, but if people could, you know, diagnose Trump from miles away, I can say that it's something to the Colin Kaepernick, Barack Obama, you know, Hannah Jones from the 1619, the founder of the 1619 Project.
She did come just short of describing it as projection, and I think I probably would have.
Well, there you go. So I say I'm not diagnosing them at all. I noticed something, and I'm asking you all listeners to go out and check it out and see if it has some merit. See if, you know, line the stuff up. Do the test, right? Peer review me and see what comes back. But, you know, we can talk about this. Like I said, 312-642-5600. Call me and tell me if you think this race thing is not as big of a deal as they make it out to be, even though they're trying to jam it down your kids' throats in school and force every politician to pass a law with it. But yeah, maybe as conservatives, we should just ignore it. That'd be the right response.
Yeah, that's never screwed us in any other way.
No, never happened.
No.
But back to the interview where it ended was, she finished with that segment, and I followed up by asking her about an article she had written about her schooling, and I ended up talking about, which we will discuss, what I kind of compared it to. But she talked about her experience becoming black after going from one school to another school. Let's play that clip.
As you kind of mentioned, the previous school was international. As you said, it was majority white, and, you know, the race wasn't really an issue. It was when I went to a school that I think was about a solid 30% or so black, I saw that the school was almost kind of split in terms of social, in the social context in the playground between black and white, not in a kind of racist way. I think that people just seem to organize themselves racially in that environment. And then I ended up being conscious of my race for the first time. Like I had to think about, you know, where I was meant to be in that particular social organization, and what it meant to be black, and what that looked like, not just in terms of, you know, skin color, but also the mannerisms and kind of stereotypes associated with it became kind of something in my consciousness. And I think that's when I really started to kind of instill race with much more meaning than perhaps just the kind of more superficial judgment or color of your skin that we are usually taught it is.
With this movement and the direction that they want to take things, especially black elites who are leading these groups, create and kind of associate all of us with a caricature of what black is, right? And I think this Black Lives Matter movement plays into that. Tell me what you think of that, about this. Whatever you think of racism, what these movements want to do is replace racism with racism, right? They say the segregation of the past was bad. They say, you know, whites having preferences of being able to vote, but blacks and women couldn't vote is bad. We all agree. So their solution, therefore, is to do the same thing, but we're just going to change the race and we get the preference too, so that makes it okay.
Yeah, and I think there's something that you said earlier, which I think is so true, which is that you kind of said that in some senses that they play on a truth, or they kind of exaggerate a truth. And slavery obviously, you know, was a horrendous thing. Colonialism happened. There's been racism in different ways within, you know, different Western societies. And they kind of play on that truth and kind of exploit that reality to kind of completely reshape the narrative. And when you and they kind of put anyone on a back foot, because obviously when we're talking about things that are traumatic and cause a lot of pain and have a lot of kind of emotional sentiment involved in them, you know, they exploit that in order to prevent any kind of discussion or debate. And I think I completely, you know, I agree with you. I think, it's a new form of racism, or even in some senses a traditional form of racism. And you see that particularly in the way that particularly Black Lives Matter activists, but just the kind of identitarian activists behave when they see a black person, for example, that doesn't think the same I think that if you are a movement that actually wants to really combat racism, which essentially is to see people as individuals, you know, and not as a kind of racial identity, then you will welcome ideological diversity. You will welcome, you know, a range of opinions because that's a reflection of people no longer viewing themselves solely through the prism of race, but they attack that. They despise that because it demonstrates to people that maybe there isn't just this kind of one way of thinking. And so, yeah, I think that the way that they behave is really a huge example of, if they did attain the kind of economic and political power that they are so seeking, then they will not be bringing about a better, more unified society. I think it will be one of a lot of resentment and revenge and bitterness, and I think it's incredibly dangerous.
Hard to argue with that.
A lot of wisdom in that young age, right? That's really important because that kind of gets to my point of why we need to continue talking about this from not necessarily a conservative, but from a logical perspective, because.
Or how about from a human perspective?
Right. But the people who
just
are saying.
Just a matter of having conversation, and people don't want to do that anymore.
But that's what they're thinking. No, but to that defense, the people who are thinking like this are thinking, well, I'm not a racist. I don't have any ill feelings about anyone. You know, I treat all humans the same. Okay, that's great. Therefore, it's offensive to constantly be, you know, throwing this race thing in my face and talking about it all the time. Okay.
Well, but yeah, in order to arrive at that point, right, it's a means to an end thing, right? You're justifying, but once you compromise your principle in pursuit of that end, then the end doesn't mean anything anymore.
Right, but you keep talking about you. The other mistake is you keep talking about you, not the racists. You this. But what about them? Those organizations who are getting money and prominence are, as I said, trying to replace racism with race. So you should be talking about this if for no other reason because you want to end the racism.
Did I mispronoun a whole group?
But coming back, we're going to talk more with Anaya. See, now you're throwing me off. About this. But for those of you who think that we should ignore it, she's got the perfect solution. We're going to talk about abolishing race when we return. You're listening to the Liberty Hour on AM 560, The Answer.
Liberty Hour. Call Sean now at 312-642-5600.
Welcome back to the Liberty Hour. Charles Love here. And we are going through an interview I did with Anaya Falarinamon, founder of the Equiano Project. She is a Black Briton and someone who writes and talks culture and race. But before we go to the next clip, we have Nick on the line from Chicago. Nick, welcome to the Liberty Hour.
Yeah, welcome too. Yeah, thank you. I love your show, Mr. Love. Really, it's a nice, relaxing show, even though the topics sometimes are serious, you know, but for Sunday evening.
I truly appreciate it, but relaxing is not the way I'm usually described. I'll take it, though. So what are your thoughts?
Okay. Well, compared to some of the big time stuff, it gets more intense. I was going to say, look, I'm 71 years old. One advantage of being older is that you live through a lot of stuff that other people sometimes read about and try to understand from reading about it. Mm-hmm. Look, in the mid-60s, when I was about 15, the civil rights laws were passed. The other thing was the Great Society Welfare Program by President Johnson, which is basically a program that made it easy to get on welfare and hard to find a job, and I criticized that. And, of course, the image was it's to help Black people, but I said it, I don't see that helping them. Even as a kid, I just understood that my way, you know. Now, I just want to say as respectfully as possible to sometimes the liberal progressive people listen and all that, and your person that you're talking to there. But look, you can't have programs forever and ever that are always in effect reparations without somehow coming to an end. The programs that made it, the grants to learn a trade, which means it's paid for, doesn't have to be paid back. 2, 3, 4 years of college paid for, doesn't have to be paid back. And I'm not trying to be insulting, and I am sensitive to the fact that sometimes Black people do get hired last and fired first, for example, but sometimes getting on welfare or unemployment is much easier as a Black person. Again, I say that, believe it or not, respectfully to the fact that they have a valid argument and say there's a reason why they get fired, you know. But I mean, how long does this go on? How long does the reparations go on? You know, I'm not quite sure if the people who demand it are not something like a union officer back in the 50s with unions who demanded more and more and more, and the mm-hmm. and their membership was in the union hall yelling out, "Yeah, we want more and more and more," and then mm-hmm. You know, so it keeps feeding upon itself. You know?
Well, Nick, but hold on a second, Nick. I think that you were close, but you're not quite there. Because you lived through this once and you saw it. So part of what I try to do is to get people to understand whether you agree or you don't agree with reparations set aside, the Great Society, all that stuff or not. That's not what's important today. What's important, especially for people your age who remember this, is that you need to understand and recognize that what is happening here is nowhere near what was happening there. What they're asking here is totally different than what they were asking there. So comparing the two is fine, but people like you need to understand that it's different and be like, hey, they're being treated, you know, admit that things were wrong and things were different. And if people are trying to fix it, that might be fine. But you got to be clear. I think you're giving these people too much credit. You need to be clear that what the 1619 Project and BLM believes and what they want to do is toxic and racist and can't be mixed with those programs, whether those programs were successful or not.
Yeah, and the distinction's sort of, you know, a difference between asking for basic human dignity and part of someone's salary. I mean, that's sort of a, you know, apples and oranges on some
level. And they've gone beyond just the salary. They want you to understand that, I mean, wait until, I keep telling you, I keep saying and not doing it, right? Every week I say, when I tell you what they really believe, you're like, really? And I'm going to give you one right now.
All right.
In the 1619 Project, the founder, Nicole Hannah-Jones.
Yeah.
Says that, forget about reparations, forget about money, forget about this. What she says is that anti-black racism is in the DNA of America. So you know what DNA is. So explain to me how then, given her their argument, because that's the way I approach it. I don't even say you're wrong. Assume you're right. So why are we wasting our energy trying to fix it? Hey, well, it's in the DNA.
Maybe she hired the random scientist guy from Jurassic Park. He got some frog DNA and he mixed American DNA with frog DNA and sort of weeded out the racism.
Right. It's like, what are you talking about? If it's in the DNA, you can't fix it. So why are we even talking about reparations? Why are we even talking about jobs? Why are we talking about anything? We can't fix it. We should just go our separate ways. Pick up your ball and go.
Yeah. Well,
that's the approach. And that's on like page one of the manifesto. I call it a manifesto sometimes because they're crazy.
Manifesto gets the attention. It
needs, you know? So, but then you go the other way. Let's do the clip real quick. So the next question to Anaya was about this movement that's going to abolish race. Play clip three.
You talked about solutions and you talk about how we fix this and you did it. You wrote an article and I believe you did. I didn't get a chance to see that one, but interview with Camille Foster. And you talked about this movement where they want to abolish race. Tell the people about that and what you think about it.
So essentially, you know, the idea of abolishing race has been around for a while, but in the kind of new generation of thinkers, it's being propagated by Thomas Chatterton Williams and Camille Foster. And it essentially argues that something that is true, which is race as a concept, or the way in which we understand it now, the kind of division of human beings into kind of biologically distinct subcategories, what emerged under particular kind of historical and social circumstances and was used as essentially a weapon to subjugate people. And so now, obviously, due to the kind of history in relation to that, people have come to define themselves along racial terms, whether that is white people or black people, you know, whether that is kind of black power, black nationalism. People have, in some senses, inverted the meaning of race in order to kind of see it as a source of, you know, strength or pride or identity, and that's really understandable. But I guess race, people that advocate for race transcendence argue that the concept of race itself is inextricably linked to racism. In order to kind of combat racism, we need to deconstruct and transcend the concept of race itself and not assign meaning either positive or negative to it.
I think it sounds great in theory. And I hope that at some point we can get there. I don't think the tenor of society right now, that we can start there. It's almost like they've gone so far in one direction. We have to bring them back to where they were, and then we have to start sitting them down and saying, this is why, this is where you want to be. And I got to get Camille on, because it would be great to talk to him and kind of go back and forth and say, like people argue socialism and capitalism. And my take is all the isms work if human nature wasn't flawed. But as long as people, at some point, regardless of the economic system, somebody's going to try to steal. So until you address that, there's only so much you can do. But I like the concept.
Man, are you hitting the nail on the head with that?
Wait till you hear the next segment. I talk about something that is a little bit different there than here, because we've been talking about a lot of similarities. So stick with us. More with Anaya Faller and Iman. When we return, you're listening to the Liberty Hour on AM 560, The Answer.
You're listening to the Liberty Hour with Sean Thompson. Get on the line with Sean by calling 312-642-5600.
Welcome back to the Liberty Hour. Charles Love here.
Nice try, Sean.
Hey, don't be like that. That's two people calling me Sean now.
Yeah, right. including caller last week, which is funny.
True that. Well, we've been listening to my interview with Anaya Faller and Iman, founder of the Equiano Project, over in the UK on the other side of the pond. And we were talking mostly about similarities, Black Lives Matter here and there. We got the 1619 Project. They have decolonized the curriculum. That crap. But here is a slight difference that I really loved. So I don't know if you saw that here, but the music, the singer Adele got into a little trouble. But it seemed like it was more here than there. So their response was pretty interesting. Play the clip.
Your article, Don't Import America's Race Wars into the UK. But we talk about some differences. This is a key one. And you tell the story about Adele. Tell the people about that and how it was taken there as opposed to here.
Yeah, so there was this Twitter storm essentially that emerged about a month ago, which was a picture of Adele in kind of carnival type outfit. She had like a Jamaican print bikini, and she posted it on social media. And within a few hours, I think, yeah, lots and lots of kind of prominent American commentators were calling her a cultural appropriator and saying she was problematic for what she was doing. And yeah, it was a real shock in Britain, because yeah, we have this thing called carnival, which emerged out of kind of racism, essentially, quite a few decades ago. And it was a celebration of kind of a multi-ethnic Britain that was emerging at that time. And it was an opportunity to celebrate kind of Afro-Caribbean culture. And it brought together white people and black people in that celebration. And it really, yeah, it was a really stark reminder for a lot of people about the differences, I think. Race in America, I think, for example, I think the New York Times now wants to capitalize B in black and W in white to make it, a demonstration that they are kind of distinct and separate categories. Obviously, I don't necessarily agree with that, but that kind of movement isn't necessarily in the UK. Kind of culture and race and class have always been a much more kind of integrated concept. And during the kind of anti-racist protests in the 80s, in Britain, you know, working class black people and white people, you know, stood together as equals, and class has always played a much greater part than race. And you know, these kind of rigid cultural silos and notions of cultural appropriation have actually been quite alien to Britain. So I think I think the kind of the division between in terms of race seems much more starker in America than perhaps in Britain.
I'm going to, you're leading me right down the path. This is wonderful, but I have to go back because you didn't give the punchline. You didn't give the people, because you know, it's just, you're like, what did I leave out? Because you already know this. Talking to Americans, give them the punchline of the Adele situation. Who came to her defense?
Oh, what, black British people? Yeah.
Exactly.
So you see there, here, we're all like, cultural appropriation, don't do that. You're white, you don't get to eat that, wear that, do that. And they're over there like, what is wrong with you? You're silly. So they haven't really adopted all of our crap. But we're getting closer to an hour, and this is the important part here. I usually approach this stuff from a kind of centrist. I always say Columbo, right? Like, excuse me, one last question. Just give them their argument. But sometimes, you know,
If you want to do it, we got to do it.
But then sometimes I have to tell them what's wrong with the black left. And here you go.
So the black left in America, I feel, you can tell me, you can defend them if you want and say you disagree. But I feel they have an inflated sense of importance. You know, they have such hubris. They are always talking about the diaspora of blacks as if all the blacks around the world think like them, or for that matter, have the same experiences. So what do black Britons think about black Americans?
Oh, that's a hard question. I think it's a love-hate relationship. I'd say it's a love relationship mainly because, you know, growing up, you know, I grew up on kind of a lot of African American TV shows and music. So the truth is, you know, black Americans do very much shape the kind of black identity in Britain. So I think the overwhelming is love, but I think that the kind of the conflict comes when black Americans seek to speak on behalf of all of us and to kind of to assume that the American experience is exactly the same as everyone else and the solutions to the American experience is the same things that need to be kind of imposed in Britain, such as kind of such as what we're talking about in terms of cultural appropriation and all that. And I think so I think I would say overall it is a love. I think in general, you know, black Americans have been a major kind of influence in terms of the kind of music, the kind of culture, all of that kind of stuff in Britain. So I'd say it's a 70% love, 30% skepticism.
So I kind of liken black Britons, not all, but a good percentage. Yeah, I would say collectively the percentage would be about the same. I liken them to Hispanics in America, right? So they are those who come here legally and they're citizens and been here a generation or two generations. They are fully American, right? They love America, whatever, but they have a tie and identity to, you know, Venezuela or Mexico, wherever they're from. Either their parents are from there or their grandparents are from there. So they have, you know, they can go back and visit family if they wanted to. It's just a connection there, but I still feel I'm American, right? But they don't tie themselves to American slavery, right? Which I'll get to the two black groups in America in a minute. And it's kind of similar to you all there, right? Whereas here, black Americans, that's where the flower is. They want to say, black people have been treated like this and this and that. You know, just like all black people all over the place. And you're like, well, my grandfather was in Kenya and I can take you to his aunt's house right now. That guy, it's a totally different thing. And so saying that they're the same seems weird. And that's why there's a subset now in the black movement where there's a group called ADOS, which is American Descendants of Slavery, saying that we're different. We don't necessarily agree with those BLM people, but we also, at the very least, understand that there's a difference between us and other blacks, like black immigrants. It's not the same experience. So at least they're not trying to paint it all with one broad brush.
Yeah, no, I think it's really important to make those distinctions. I mean, in Britain, again, the black experience, so-called, is really one of heterogeneity. You've got kind of immigrants from, you know, the immediate post-war years from Jamaica who came to work, you know, in the Windrush generations in kind of lower skilled jobs. Then you had, you know, immigrants from, you know, in the last 10, 20 years from war-torn Somalia. And then you have kind of middle-class West African immigrants in the 90s. So we're talking about massively culturally, ethnically, and historically divergent groups. And it's really important to make those distinctions, the kind of broad category and homogenizing it. I think, it's actually quite erasing. I think it's important to understand the nuances and complexities of the kind of diversity of the black experience. And that's a beautiful story. And I think, the Black Lives Matter narrative seeks to actually erase history when they're the ones trying to argue that they're trying to, bring history to light. But actually, I think they brush over all of those differences.
Yeah. And, you know, this is a great conversation. I can go on for another hour, but for you, it's dinner time. You probably got some things to get on the way. But I want to ask if there's anything you want to mention or anything you want to promo or anything you got coming up, you know, tell the people about them, because you are definitely someone that everyone needs to follow.
Well, yeah, I just recommend everyone check out the EquianoProject.com, and it's got, yeah, all of these things that we've been talking about. You know, we're having these conversations in the UK as well, from like, yeah, the curriculum, education, you know, culture, you know, race, identity, transcending race, all of these things. And I think it's really important for us, despite the differences in term, you know, between Britain and America, to kind of continue that that kind of cross-Atlantic engagement, because I think there's a lot we can both learn from each other in terms of what is right to do and perhaps what is also a wrong way to approach it.
She is Anaya Florin Iman, founder of the Equiano Project. You're listening to The Liberty Hour on AM 560, The Answer.
But wait, there's more.
This is The Liberty Hour. Here's your host, Sean Thompson, on AM 560, The Answer.
Welcome to the Liberty Hour. I'm your host, Sean Thompson.
I went with a short intro there.
Well, the guy told me I was Sean, so I believed him.
Really? Is that's not what it takes to convince you of something, is it?
Maybe. Charles Love here for Sean. And as we normally do every Sunday at this time, we have with us Patrick Brutus, our frustrated Democrat. He's got to be a little less frustrated than normal, you know, with what's going on in politics. Hey, Patrick, how are you?
Hey, what's going on, Charles? Hey, Macbeth. Good evening. Hey, what's going on?
Everything's good. You know, the clip at the end of the hour ran right to the end, so I didn't get a chance to give everyone Anaya's website, which is Equiano Project. It's EquianoProject.com. Patrick, you say you are contractually obligated to listen to this boring show because you're coming on. What'd you think of the first hour? What'd you think of that interview?
That was an amazing conversation. Wow, that was amazing.
Dude, she's 23. She's 23, Patrick. She's 23.
Yeah,
I didn't say that before. I'm like, should I say it online? Then I looked at her website. She's got a birthday on it. She is 23.
Yeah, she sounds way more wiser and older and more mature for her age, doesn't she?
She gets it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what's important.
Yeah, no.
And I get a lot, you know, so I always come in here and Macbeth is like, what's the big deal? It makes sense. But I always talk about why I talk about these things, because when I'm not on air, I get a lot of, you know, those things. So I assume some listeners may be thinking, you know, why is this such an important topic?
Come on, man.
But they don't know just how crazy these people are. I mean, you know, the DNA thing. Did you know about that, Patrick? Did you know that
no,
the 1619 Project say that it's in the DNA?
I didn't know they said it was in the DNA.
Yeah.
That's even deeper than I would have ever imagined, right?
Now, is that a paraphrase or is that word for word?
No. Not only is it word for word, it's in. So Nicole Hannah-Jones wrote the, she's the founder of the project. So she runs, does the lead essay, which basically says this is our purpose,
right?
But then it's followed by people who do essays on separate topics, and several, at least
the
three
theme
of them say it. Yeah, they say it. And also people need to understand this. I'll give you another little nugget. Everyone says who doesn't agree with Black Lives Matter, not that they say that Black Lives don't matter, but they don't agree with the organization. They don't like the way they approach things, and they don't agree with systemic racism. You see, that's the gotcha question on the left. Everybody, Trump, Bill Barr, everybody has to answer that question, right? Well, they make this a lot easier for you, because the 1619 Project does not say that the country has a systemic racism problem. No. That's child's play. Keep in mind, this is being pushed in your schools of all your kids and your grandkids. For those of you who say, don't talk about this. They say every problem that blacks are facing today is born out of slavery. I didn't say racism. I said slavery. And they proceed to point out why.
You know, the funny thing is, slavery ended over 150 years ago.
Did it?
Right?
Did it?
I mean, it technically did. I mean,
not according to those essays I've been reading.
You know, I even go as far as going to 1865. I'll take the 2 years for the
Emancipation
Proclamation to make it across the country in June 19th and all that. And I go to 1865, and just from there, you have 155 years of freedom, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so
a lot of those freedoms were suppressed.
Yeah,
a lot of racist people tried to fight it back.
That's six generations, Charles. Six generations removed from the last person who was freed under the act, right? And so,
right. Go on.
I mean, come on. I mean, I understand systemic racism is in place because the people who control the systems may have been born in it be legacy, right? But you can look at all the economic factors. But like in terms of equality, I think we have parity.
Well, in terms of a snapshot of right now.
Oh, speaking of right now, you did a video recently where you say let's talk about it, right? That's what you say. So let's talk about it. It's funny. This segues into that because you're saying that people at that you talk about the fact that, you know, the system is the problem. Well, according to you, we got people at the table.
Right. So thanks for I didn't see that coming, but thanks, Charles. I appreciate it. So I introduced a new Patrick Brutus Presents Let's Talk About It Facebook page where I'm going to, you know, do videos introducing topics or asking questions and just trying to really spark conversation, trying to encourage folks to actually videotape their response back because I think we get lost in translation in typing all caps and bold caps and things of that nature. And people get the wrong sometimes message when we respond.
And why the letters got to be black when I type? Why the letters got to be black?
Right. all the white background, right?
You know? Exactly. That's too much white.
But today's first post was about why, you know, we as, you know, minorities, black folks, people of color, whatever, we always say that if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And I contend that we are at the table. We're at every single table where meetings are taking place, discussing policy and making negotiable deals to, you know, get equity. But I think the reason why black people still think that we're on the menu is because we have the wrong people at the table. But we're certainly at the table, Charles. We're at the table, left, right, you know, any type of industry, entertainment, sports, academia, you know, politics, business. We're at the table. We just have the wrong people at the table, right? Because if we still think we're on the menu, then the wrong people are negotiating on behalf of black people. And so, you know, that doesn't have anything to do with a systemic racism. That has everything to do with systemic capitalism, right? In terms of who's guarding the hen house.
Right.
And I think that sometimes we have people who have tasted the champagne and guess what, Charles? They like how it tastes. So don't want to share the bottle. They don't want to puff, puff, pass. They want to take the whole thing for themselves.
Right.
And so those people are the wrong people that are negotiating for the people who are the have-nots. And those people who used to be the have-nots who are at the table negotiating on behalf of the have-gots are some of those people who are, they're have-gots and some of them are like have a little bit, right? But they certainly aren't negotiating for the
have-gots. And don't forget about the other ones. Don't forget the have-gotten after they got to the table. Those are the worst. I didn't have, but then I got to the table and now I got.
Right. And now I got. And then, and then there's a now I got. Right. And so, so we'll see how this goes. But I certainly think that's a conversation worth having because I think people really need to explore the deeper meanings behind the things that we're seeing and the things that especially that we're not seeing.
Well, that's the reason why I think all this stuff keeps tying back to my topic. Like, that's why talking about it in a context, in the right context and in a nuanced way, it makes sense. So I talk about Black Lives Matter, 1619 Project, racism. You're like, what does that got to do with this, this, that, the other? But you just talked about getting the right policies in place and doing things that will make it equitable and equality for everyone and having the right person at the table. Well, I would say, okay, you say, and you want the right person at the table. Minorities say we need more people of color at the table. Well, the founder of this 1619 Project is black. They're going to put our project in 90% of the public schools. So she's at the table. She's moving and shaking. Give you another little tidbit. I'm about to drop another one for you, Macbeth. I think there's 13 essays in the 1619 Project. Not once, zero, never, not once, zero times do they offer a solution. I don't even mean a bad solution, people. I'm not saying they're saying, well, if we gave everybody a leatherback chair, that'll solve the problem. And I'm like, that's a silly solution. I mean, there is no leatherback chair. They don't say anything.
No
solution. They drop a bomb. Right. Slavery is bad. We still feel it. White people DNA. And then they walk away.
You ain't so, black.
So right. And I think Biden says that in one of the essays. I'm kidding. But so that's the problem. You say, some of you, that the two issues aren't tied. I say it's two sides of the same coin. Right? You got one people, you got a group of people saying, we're just trying to get the right politician who's going to do the right thing for the whole country. And then you have a segment saying, no, what are you going to do for us? And the first group of people saying, well, that's wrong. We're all us, not just you. But that's true. But even if they do believe, what are you going to do for us? The people that they're talking to are not equipped to do. They don't have an idea. And I keep telling you, I say it all the time on the Black Table here every day. It's not an education thing. I need to make that clear because that's where people get fooled. One, you get people say, well, that guy went to Harvard. He's smart, which may be true. Or people on my side will say that guy's just dumb. No, you oversimplifying. Most of these people are smart and credentialed and they know their stuff. But when you are, what do I say, Patrick? When you are emotionally weak and intellectually lazy,
that
allows something. See, that's what the definition is. That means I went to Harvard. I know my stuff. But if I'm guided by emotion, I still sound like somebody who dropped out at junior high school. Because I'm guided by emotion. That's why these things matter. It will matter. It will dictate what your tax policy is, right? Because Gavin Newsom, just what did he just say? We're going to study reparations in California. Somebody, you know, New York, California and Illinois all follow each other. So at some point, Jelly Belly is going to do the same thing. Cuomo is going to do the same thing. And that is going to affect everybody's taxes and a budget that's already deficit. And you're going to say, well, how did this happen? Now, I'm going to say because you wouldn't talk about race. So well, I guess you get to respond. He's playing music, so I guess you get to respond when we come back.
I can stop the music.
Well, I know that, but we have to follow the musical rules. Yeah, we gotta do all that stuff. So coming back, we'll talk more with Patrick Brewers, our frustrated Democrat. You're listening to the Liberty Hour on AM 560, The Answer.
Show some R-E-S-P-I-C-T.
This is the Liberty Hour. Here's your host, Sean Thompson, on AM 560, The Answer.
Everybody knows that the days are loaded.
Welcome back to the Liberty Hour. Charles Love here with Patrick Brutus. Did we confirm that he was the less frustrated Democrat?
He seems pretty benign tonight, but yes. I don't want to pass it up.
I had the angry Democrat the other day, but we'll get to that.
Don't get me riled up because I was mad the other day.
He was really mad. He was not frustrated. So, what are your COVID numbers like there in Illinois?
So we are at over 5.6 million tested in our state.
That's almost half.
No idea how many of those are repeats of.
I
don't think they show how many are repeat, but like in Chicago, we have, I believe, over 80,000 infected, right? So these are as of October 1st numbers. So we have 295,440 confirmed cases in our state. But what's been happening recently, we've had a lot of days where we've had 2,000 plus positive test results, right? So to me, that shows we're on an upswing, right? Mm-hmm. We're on the other side of the curve going back up. This is the second wave. Mm-hmm. And what's amazing, Charles, is that throughout this recent uptrend in, the usual 2,000 plus confirmed cases per day, we are at the state level, as well as here in Chicago, making provisions to allow trick-or-treating.
Yeah, there we go. You got a trick and or treat, one of the two.
I can shed a little light on that.
Okay.
Right?
Because
you've only got 4 days between Halloween and the election, and we saw in March that COVID in Illinois is not as deadly when it's around an election. It's fine to have an election, but it's not fine to have a church service. So because Halloween is so close to the election, virus not as deadly.
And remember, in March, for the March primary, Pritzker knew that COVID was around.
Yeah, he went out of his way to
make
sure.
He still allowed in-person.
100%. I was there then.
Because
I came into town and I landed and they had shut all the restaurants and everything down that Friday night. But then Tuesday, you can still go vote.
Right, right. And so here we are. We're having the same lead-in to Election Day, and I'm and thanks for bringing that up, Macbeth. I wasn't thinking that way, but you're absolutely right. We have the same lead-in to Election Day, and we're going to let all the kids and all the parents go around all these places and do trick-or-treating.
Uh-huh.
And we're supposed to, you know, not worry about it because Chicago has a new superhero.
Oh, really?
Yes, we have Rona, Rona Destroyer. So we have a new superhero, so we don't have to worry about any positive results after Halloween.
Well, I can say this.
The one thing that's going to fix all that.
The one thing we can all agree on is that one thing that we learned is that what's the title again? I like yours better than mine. Who is that person again?
Rona Destroyer.
No, what's the person who dressed up as Rona Destroyer? What's her title?
Oh, yeah, it's the CEO of the municipal corporation known as Chicago.
Yeah, that CEO, one thing we learned is she likes to play characters. She likes to play act. Right,
yeah.
We had her in the cowboy hat. We had her doing the PSA videos. We had her with the memes. She likes it. You know, she likes to dress up.
Mm. Well, you know, it's
feeling cute. Might close your church later. Don't know.
Stop the car and instead of turning around, get out and walk away.
And you know, I try to always be extremely positive when it comes to discussing. Chicago, right, but this week has been really strange. You know, last week we had the cowboy get busted, and, that was somebody who was on the payroll to advance the idea that the census was a critical need for Illinois and Chicago. Obviously, we're losing congressional seats, and that affects federal funding.
Yeah.
And then, he rides the horse on the highway, gets the horse impounded, he gets a ticket, he goes to jail. It's a whole, soap opera in Chicago. And then this week, comes out in a Clorox uniform superhero thing, and
I don't think that's characterization
in the
of the
same
COVID
in the
cover.
Same weekend, but it's the same week for the president. It's the wow.
Well, look at it this way: he was killing many birds with one stone, right? Because anytime somebody sees him and associates him with Lightfoot, okay, that calls attention to the census. Mission accomplished.
Right.
You're calling mission attention to violence against children. Plenty of media coverage. Plenty of times that got out. Mission accomplished. Also, putting animal cruelty right on the front burner for everybody. It's awareness. Gaining awareness. So he's a triple
threat. That's a trifecta. That's a triple threat trifecta.
Can I ask you a side note? Sometimes the mind just the things just come up. And maybe Beth, you brought it up. Maybe why is the census only important to minorities? I thought the census was for everyone. I mean, but now every ad I see, every billboard, every commercial, every person talking about it, it's always, you gotta count, otherwise they won't know you're Hispanic. Gotta count, otherwise they won't know you're black.
This might be a good topic for the black table this week, but I tell you, you're absolutely right.
I want to know, does the census count white people? That should be the first question. Does the census include white people? Go.
Yes.
No, not you. I'm saying that should be our first question on the show Thursday. It should be
rapid fire.
So that's interesting. I just noticed that as a side note. So he mentioned census. I'm like, wait a minute. Now that you mention it, the only ads are for blacks and Hispanics. Huh. Imagine that.
Yeah. They used to count everybody. Maybe they're going to count as double. I don't know. We're going to count for two. It's going to be the reverse of the 13th Amendment. So.
And.
Macbeth, that was your big shot for the drum roll, Macbeth.
No, I don't do drum rolls. I do crickets.
The rim shot. Ba-ding-ching.
Yeah. That's a little too cheesy. I don't have anything like that. So we're just off the rails now. Let's go.
So what else you got in good old Chicago?
Well, as we always go, this week I did not count because last week I was so frustrated and not happy.
All right, because it was like 100 for that week.
It was 100 for the week, 101, I believe it was. So, I've just stuck, to the facts, and I'm going to give you the weekend numbers so far. But I was right last week. There was an uptick Sunday evening after we signed off, and the next morning we had a little bit more, I think it was 17 more shootings. But so far this weekend, Charles, we're at 31 shot and two killed. And so I think everyone would consider that a good thing.
Of course, it's weird. But yeah,
do we need to ask Matthew McConaughey?
I pumped those numbers up. Those are rookie numbers.
All right, Matthew McConaughey's a little outside the box on that one, but yeah, that's better than it has been in many weeks.
Right, right. So, you know, I want to credit the cold weather, and I'm hoping that that number holds and doesn't increase overnight. And we'll see, you know, tomorrow morning that it, you know, stayed at 31 and 2.
Well, Halloween's on a Saturday. We have that to look forward to.
Another random question. I think I asked this a few weeks ago, but it keeps happening here. Do you all have a spike in stabbings there, or is it just all just the good old fashioned shootings? Because we like to stab people here in New York for some reason.
Yeah. So last week we had about 3 stabbings, which was rare, especially that they called it out.
Now you can play Matthew McConaughey, because I think we get 3 stabbings a day. But
that's just on the subway.
Let me say one thing to our fans. Even though we seem to be making light of these numbers, we're being really serious in the sense that, you know, any death is one death too many. And these are, a perilous times that we're living in right now. But, you have to, laugh to keep from crying sometimes because, you know, this is a consistent, thing in our society where we're just seeing the violence, run out of control and run amok.
We're not making fun of the violence or the people getting hurt. We're making fun of the people who are out there parading around, pretending to stand for people's lives mattering, who will just utterly ignore this because it's inconvenient to their narrative. That's what we're making fun of, not the violence itself.
We got a couple seconds here on the way out, Patrick. Do you you can just say no comment, but we both saw that flyer for the Black Conservatives for Trump thing. You got a comment you want to make about the person on the flyer?
Both of them did not show.
I wonder why.
It was a double no show.
Ouch.
Well, I will have to do that solo. It was great having you as always, and we will talk to you next week.
You guys have a great week.
Yeah. Thank you, man. Patrick Brutus here on the Liberty Hour. Coming up, Trump and COVID.
Now, back to the Liberty Hour. Call Sean now at 312-642-5600.
Welcome back to the Liberty Hour. That was 312-642-5600.
That's it.
We're talking Trump and COVID. Give Sean a call.
How many people are going to call in between 5 to 7 on the weekdays when Sean's actually on the air? And say, Charles told me to call Sunday night, so I waited till
so
now.
I just waited, right.
Are you still on this topic?
Yeah. Right, exactly. So Trump and COVID. I don't know. We can coin toss. Let's go.
Are they inseparable at this point?
I think we have Trump to take them apart, put them back together, and then take them apart and put them back together.
Fair enough.
Because the COVID thing is the biggest news now, but hey, we're only here once a week. And when we left, that hadn't been a debate yet. And so now, if that's what you want to call that thing.
I can call it a number of things, just not on the radio.
Yeah, I don't want to get into all that. The madness that it was. Just to say it was bad, they was bad, they were bad, Trump was bad, Biden was bad, Wallace was bad, it was bad.
Yeah, the camera work was excellent.
Yeah.
Audio was
and
not
it
bad.
Stayed on. Yeah, it stayed on.
Technically, it was a fantastic production. was that a mess.
Yeah, it was a mess, and no one answered questions.
Lots of missed opportunities.
Everyone talked over each other. Lots of missed opportunities on both sides, really.
So we can actually simulate the debate right now. Okay. Yeah. See, nobody understood either of us at that point, so there's no point.
But in that debate, the thing that stood out to me the most, which won't surprise people when I mention it because of what I talk about, it got buried.
Yeah.
Because everybody talked about the white supremacy question and the gotcha questions for both of them and the interrupting. But Trump was asked about the training things and the critical race theory. And he gave his answer. Well, I think it's bad. It's da, 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 da. And Chris Wallace said with a straight face, a 70-year-old white man said, well, are you really saying it's wrong? There's something wrong with that? Wait, are you saying there's something wrong?
Well, did you catch how he termed it? He termed it racial sensitivity training.
Yeah, that's what he called it. Yep. Is there something wrong with racial sensitivity training? Well, yes, Chris. There's something wrong with teaching people that they're beneath you because of their race. Yes, Chris, there's something wrong with that, you moron.
Idiot.
But Trump didn't have it in him to say that. I don't care about the rest of the debate. For 15 seconds then, I just wish I could speak for Trump.
Yeah.
Hey, you moronic loser.
And it is wrong
for me to say to you that you are beneath anyone else because of your race that you cannot control.
Yeah, that was the least of the missed opportunities. I think that was the second most frustrating thing after just the mess that it was. I keep trying to say things that I can't say.
Everything about it was bad.
But that really, you know, I didn't watch it live. I watched it later on that night.
People were telling me Wallace did a great job. I'm like, what?
What?
But then it gets to COVID. So Biden's thing, Trump's biggest mistake, though, was not allowing Biden to make the mistake he would have made. Because he also said nothing. He said nothing. So my thing is this COVID thing.
Well,
he
said Trump didn't act soon enough. So apparently we should have closed travel from China before we knew about the virus.
We should have done it in 2018. And at some point it wouldn't have been racist. But anyway, but beyond that, I give him an argument. So Trump has done a terrible job. If I were president, I'd fix it. Well, what would you do? I don't know. Because what is he saying? He would just shut down every state? So what do you do when the states say we're not going to listen? You're going to send troops?
I don't know.
He has no idea. Everybody knows he has no plan.
Come on, man.
Come on, man. That's what he would have said. Close your state. No, I don't want to. Come on, man.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous it's just senseless that people are like, well, that's better than Trump. How? It's nothing. He hasn't said anything. He just said, I would have been better. Well, what would you have done? Better? I would have done Mo' Better. It would be like a Spike Lee movie. Mo' Better. Mo' Better COVID. That's what he would have given.
And if you're Biden, really, all you have to do to win points on that question is go, well, I wouldn't have tweeted. And then you can get half the audience laughing for you. If there was even an audience, I don't know if there was.
We don't do audiences.
Nah, but you say it's like Jim staff members or something.
Is Jim from South Elgin still there? He has a comment about COVID. Yeah. Jim, welcome to the Liberty Hour. Let's talk COVID. What's up, Jim?
Well, you know what I'm realizing is the media coverage of COVID is the same way the media covered AIDS, HIV, when it was first coming out. Because nobody knew what was going on. If you had AIDS back then, it was a death sentence.
Yeah, you could get it from kissing people and.
Well,
everybody
actually,
had
the government
it,
right. changed later on. They said, well, if you have relatives, you won't get the AIDS virus. But initially, that's what it was.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
So the media is treating COVID like AIDS, and that's why people are being afraid. Right. And people have to understand a lot of this stuff is just hyped up. You know, the survival rate is unbelievably high.
But let me
it's
tell
like
you this, though.
Cold.
Right, you're right. But here's the thing. Don't you think that we would have been better served if those people who think it's being exaggerated, the seriousness of it, like the death sentence of it, would have been done a better job from Trump on down of messaging it? What people made mistake of doing, they went from, it's not everybody who gets it is not going to die, calm down. But that's not what they said. What they said was, it's a hoax, or nobody's really getting it, or, you know, whatever. So I think that they should, just like everything else, it's the messaging, and it was messaged poorly.
Well, see, the problem is, you know, Trump, you know, banned the flights from China, and he was criticized for it. And, of course, Nancy and everybody else said, oh, it's not a big deal. There's you know, video of Fauci in February saying, oh, don't worry about it. You don't need a mask. And so the dynamic kept on changing.
Right. And he was supposed to act like he's the doctor, and he was supposed to know that all the way back then. I'm reacting to what they tell me. So I say it's not that bad. Then they tell me this, and I say that. What do you want him to do? It's like, you can only do with what you can with the best information you got. So I will give the left that his rhetoric has been terrible, because it always is. He could always speak better. But they say his reaction. So did he close the border? Did he send the ship, the Comfort, to New York? Did he say, they kept saying they use it. And then ignoring, well, he should have got his ventilators. He did, but he should have got them faster. Did you use them? Well, no, I didn't use them, but still. What? Then how is it a failure if you didn't even use the stuff? You ended up giving them to other states. Well, because I wanted them, he didn't give them to me when I demanded them. You got to remember, when this broke, I was in New York. So I was here when they were on TV saying everybody was dying. And I'm looking around like, what are you talking about? You know, my son had an emergency. He went to the hospital, and we were the only ones in the emergency room. I rarely tell that story because I don't get personal. But there was nobody in it. It was in New York City. Nobody was in the hospital. He was the only person there.
You know, you were talking about, you know, the point at which, you know, the message kind of turns, right? And mm-hmm. I think, and we're a little bit over for a break, so we're going to have to
yeah, I see it. Here, yep.
But, you know, I was
thanks,
around,
Jim.
I was a kid. Yes, thank you, Jim. I was a kid when Ryan White passed away. And if anybody who doesn't remember who Ryan White was, mm-hmm. he was essentially the first young, non-stereotypical AIDS patient, right? At that point, AIDS was mm-hmm. considered sort of a disease of the homosexual and drug-related right. and everything else, which it may have been either through chance or just through basic circumstance. But Ryan White wasn't that. Ryan White was the kid who got it from, I believe it was a blood transfusion.
Blood transfusion, yep.
And so that broke a lot of the messaging stereotypes. And I don't know that, you know, Trump live tweeting from Walter Reed is enough to break some of the messaging stereotypes on COVID for either side.
Well, we'll get to that on the other side. I think he could have done that if he wasn't Trump and he did it better. But we will talk about COVID, a little bit more Trump, but COVID when we come back on the other side. You're listening to the Liberty Hour on AM 560 The Answer.
You're listening to the Liberty Hour with Sean Thompson. Get on the line with Sean by calling 312-642-5600.
Welcome back to the Liberty Hour. Charles Love here. We were talking Trump and COVID. We're going to go heavy COVID here. But I do want to make one last point about that debate in Trump. One thing it did for me, and I watched half of it on mute just to hear the questions and then read some transcripts. But it did separate out those people who are, you know, truly trying to find the best candidate, or they've already made up their mind, but they still want to see what happened.
Aiming to get triggered.
Right. Or those full on, you know, the people who just love Trump blindly and say this, whatever, because the first thing I wanted to see after that debate was go to Twitter and find out of those MAGA hat wearers, the Trump lovers, how many of them was going to say, woohoo, that was a great debate. And there were a surprising number of them. I was kind of shocked by it. I mean, I knew there'd be some, but there was a lot of, I mean, some of my friends, most of my friends who are big Trump fans were like, yeah, he could have done better, whatever. But some of them was like, yeah, it was great. I mean, it was awesome. I love the way he was cutting them up. I was like, yeah. You do realize he sucked, right?
There's a certain amount of people just not being honest with themselves.
I'm like, you do realize he absolutely sucked, and I thought he was three. So you didn't think he was three when you watched it? You didn't think he was three? Okay, just check it. So, I mean, you got to give it to him. I mean, that's not a glaring report on Biden. It's just saying, you know, he was three. He should have been at least seven, right? It's somewhere around where he normally is, 12 or 30. Oh, now I'm really going to get in trouble. But
I was encouraged by one thing, though. There seemed to be, for the most part, okay, for the most part, there's exceptions to everything. But for the most part, it seems like the entirety of the United States and indeed the world hates Chris Wallace. So that gives me hope that maybe we can come together over common bonds and common opinions.
And to be fair, what other surprised me, I didn't hear a lot of people saying Biden was good either. They just said Trump was bad, whatever. But what do you think?
I've got a number of very liberal friends who privately, not in like Facebook statuses and that, but just in text messaging, they were very upset at the Supreme Court answer specific or non-answer specifically.
Right. Yeah, they were pissed.
One of them wanted him to say, yeah, we will put as many justices there as it takes to counteract what's been done over the last 4 years. And two of them just said that it just the optics were so bad
of
trying to get around a question, not committing to one of the basic tenets of the Constitution.
Right.
So,
he had another one that he didn't answer too, but yeah, that was just a comment for that. But that's enough with that. So back to this COVID thing.
Yeah.
I was saying before the break that Biden has no clue. And I would argue that most people didn't. That's what happens when you have something for the first time that you haven't dealt with.
Right.
So I'm always talking here. You listen to me on the show. You know I always say that every interview. No different here. Well, what's your solution? We can have our debate and talk about that. That's fine. That's cool. It's important. Let people hear two sides. But at the end, how do we fix this? So I say, what do you do? So I talk to most of my liberal friends and I say, okay, you hate Trump's response. Go. You can't say if Biden were president, would he do better? Because he wasn't president. Trump's president. So tell me, Trump's in office, what he should have done that would have been good. So I say, you all hated that he closed the border, so that didn't work. So what did you want to do? And they start off by telling you what they wouldn't do. Well, I wouldn't tweet about it. Not what I asked you. What do you do? And they never really give you a logical response, right? They'll say, well, maybe he should do this or maybe he should do that. And you say that's not true. So, well, he should have shut things down earlier. Really? Yeah. Well, because the states didn't know what to do. It was up in arms. He should have made a decision. What did that look like? What would that have looked like? And they say, what do you mean? So he wanted to shut down Texas and Florida. And the governor said, no. What did you want him to do? Send in troops? Because you were already calling him a fascist. Explain to me what Nancy Pelosi would have said if he said that's what he wanted to do.
Right.
How was he going to stop? In New York City, remember I was here at the time, they were body slamming people in the street for not wearing masks.
And at the beginning, Nancy Pelosi was saying, no, go down to Chinatown.
She's
talking
about
San Francisco.
Right.
She's talking about not believing the hysteria of the crazy right.
We're here in Chicago. Where was the NBA All-Star game? And when was it?
Yeah.
Stick with us on the other side. You're listening to the Liberty Hour on AM 560, The Answer.
Nice try, Sean.
This is the Liberty Hour. Here's your host, Sean Thompson, on AM 560, The Answer.
Welcome back to the last segment of the Liberty Hour this weekend. As we say, 2 hours go by fast.
It really does.
So I think we got a bit of a challenge. I want to go to Dave in Niles. Dave, welcome to the Liberty Hour.
A fantastic show. I just hope you guys keep rocking with it. Unbelievably good.
Oh, that was, I wasn't expecting that. I mean, I thought you were going to come and punch me.
Just a clarification, right? Just a clarification that Trump never said that the virus was a hoax. He never inferred it was a hoax. He never acted like it was a hoax.
Right.
Okay. And the thing is, he also had to walk the tightrope because we have a lot of forces out there that would like to take us down. Mm-hmm. You can't let people know when you're weak, and you can't run around with your hair on fire.
Well, you're 100% correct.
You have to show leadership. That's what leadership's all about. When it comes to the debate, looking at the record, he drew Biden out to get Biden to say things on the record and to leave things off the record that really helped draw out who Joe Biden really is.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's true. You know, I appreciate it. You know, I would like to, clarify, is that when I was talking about hoax, it may have run together, but I was saying, keep in mind, the problem with the message, don't you think that the people who think that COVID is being overblown would do a better service to everybody if they explained it better. But you got some people who are saying it's a
live
hoax. Some people this. Yeah. Right. I was kind of listing
and
things
you hit,
up.
And you
I didn't say
nail.
Trump said. I didn't say Trump said it was a hoax. I agree with you. He never said that and he never implied it. That's
talking
true.
About media
and
hysteria.
And you really hit it the nail on the head. It was a brand new thing. It came out of left field. Exactly. Just like you're saying. And right. It had to be dealt with. Right. Right.
Well,
thank
I
you for all
it.
That you do.
Thank you. I appreciate it. What
I'm glad to know Dave's car's locked. Hopefully he's still listening.
I just think that the goal should have been to do whatever you can to protect America and inform people and get in front of the virus. Once it becomes political, everybody's going to lose. So, yeah, I honestly say it would have been smoother if Obama was president at the time, not because he was a better president, because nobody would have been up. See, you were almost going to have to. Nobody would have been trying to make, not just trying to stop him from succeeding, but make him look bad at every turn. Oh, look, he told us to do this. We shouldn't do it. Oh, look, he told us to do this. We shouldn't.
Well,
do it. Oh,
no,
you know, that kind of
let's
thing.
Let's not discount the vast right wing conspiracy. you know, that's always out to get every leftist as it reelects him. There's a lot of sort of, you know, waves of cognitive dissonance washing over the shores of rationality here. And
right,
I think,
look at right now, they're saying it's his fault, right? It's
right.
So my first question to that was, so you're telling me no one who wears a mask regularly has gotten COVID? Because if the answer is no, shut the front door.
Exactly.
The front
and
door.
And the point of what I was saying is just that, you know, if you look, like, let me say something else that's also stupid and somewhat clever. Right. The era of digital movies is in, right? The era of Netflix and Amazon Prime and all this stuff. You don't have projectionists in theaters anymore. But now what you have is projectionists occupying half of the political spectrum in the United States.
I see what you did.
Because every single criticism they lay against Trump and more broadly congressional Republicans, national Republicans, it almost word for word, tier for tier, is literally what's in their playbook, what they've been spouting for the last 8 months to 4 years. And it's just comical to watch.
I lay that out in my book too, in the 1619 Project, because they say that.
I'm gonna have to get and read that book. What was the name again?
I don't know. It doesn't have one yet. You need to give me some ideas.
Great Answer.
That is an awesome book. Maybe I'll call it Great Answer. Dude, I finished writing it this morning. I haven't even edited it yet. Who knows what the name
Dude
is?
Dude, a but, bit. Yeah.
Yeah. We're, but it's going to be important. You should buy 12 copies, actually.
If I had 11 friends, I would.
Pass them out to strangers on the street. Well, thank you all for joining us again this week. And hopefully we entertained you and taught you. You've been listening to The Liberty Hour on AM 560, The Answer.
I have to go home. I have to go home.